Russia launching more than 150 rockets and drones in this attack that went on for some 10 hours. Ukraine's Air Force says that it is the largest attack on the country since the start of the full-scale invasion. And this, of course, comes as the U.S. has just announced a $250 million aid package for Ukraine. But 2024 promises to be another difficult year as Ukraine pleads for more support from the West.
Yeah, good afternoon, friends. Happy Friday. Welcome aboard. Rob Breckenridge with you here as we get set to close out 2023, our final show of 2023. And yes, let's begin with the news out of Ukraine as we get closer to the second anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Today, Russia launching, at last count, we believe, 122 missiles and 36 drones across Ukraine. Striking in civilian areas, striking a maternity hospital, striking an apartment building. Ukraine's Air Force says they've never seen so many locations targeted simultaneously. So it's certainly a reminder of the challenge that Ukraine still faces in fending off this Russian invasion. Whether this marks any kind of an escalation on Putin's part, I guess we'll have to wait and see. But this conflict does continue to drag on here, unfortunately, as we get into the third year of this conflict. Joining us for some thoughts on all of this, very pleased to welcome in the program here this afternoon, Earl Braun, Professor of International Relations and Political Science at the University of Toronto, also an associate with the Davis Center at Harvard University. Professor Braun, good to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First of all, let's talk about the missile attacks today. Just, you know, in terms of sheer numbers, it's quite something. What's its signal or signify to you?
Russia is sending messages to the domestic population in Russia that they're winning. They are testing Ukraine and they are testing the West. This was a vast attack that has resulted, according to the latest reports from Kyiv, in at least 30 people dying. It's a terrible loss. There were targets that were civilian as well as military industrial targets. The manufacturer of missiles and aircraft parts in Kyiv, the Artem factory was also hit. But this was meant both to inflict pain, but also to terrorize Ukraine, to test the West, to tell the West that Russia will continue fighting and that Putin is not giving up.
Well, that much is clear. I mean, you know, certainly this war has come at a tremendous cost to Russia, both in terms of the financial cost of waging this war and the toll that this has inflicted on a generation of young Russian men. But Putin seems, you know, determined to see this through, whatever that is.
He doesn't have much choice because of the kind of regime that he runs. He cannot afford to lose. If he loses, he's gone. He's not going to get to retire and write his memoirs. In this kind of system, you either win or you have no backup plan. There's no plan B to this. And so even if he doesn't win in our terms, he has to be able at least to pretend that he is winning. This is a repressive regime. This is a tyranny. And what we see is that tyrannies and terrorists are testing democracies. They are testing our endurance. Are we going to continue to support other democracies? Are we going to support Ukraine? And we know that the support that Ukraine was counting on, there's something like $50 billion that was to be allocated in the United States, that is being held up. And Vladimir Putin may not be able to win in real terms, but he believes that the West can lose.
Well, look, I mean, if, as you say, we're at a bit of a tipping point here in terms of providing support to Ukraine. I mean, absent that support, you know, a Russian victory could very much materialize.
It wouldn't be so much as Russia winning as the West and Ukraine losing.
Right.
So far, if you look at it objectively, Russia has done terribly. This has been a strategic disaster for Russia. We know from various intelligence sources that they now have leaked a lot of material to the media that at least 315,000 Russian soldiers have either been killed or severely wounded to the extent that they cannot participate. This is an enormous loss. This means that Russia has lost more soldiers in Ukraine than in all of the conflict that it has participated in since the end of the Second World War. We know that today's attack, for which they seem to have saved up a lot of these missiles. These missiles, 158 missiles and drones together, would have cost at least $1.2 billion. They can't afford to keep doing that. But what Putin is counting on, and what terrorists around the world are counting on, including terrorist regimes such as Iran, that the West doesn't have the endurance, that the West is not willing to step up on a sustainable basis, and that the West, which to Vladimir Putin and to Islamists is morally corrupt, the West will just fall apart, and that is the only way they can win. Otherwise, Russia does not have the capacity to do so. They do not have the resources. There are all sorts of negative indications inside Russia. Some mothers are protesting that their sons are being drafted, that they're being killed. Hundreds of thousands of young Russians, some of the brightest in the country, have left because they do not want to be drafted into a military, which is a high likelihood that they would be either killed or wounded. So there are enormous problems within Russia, and the only way they can prevail is if we give up, basically, if we give up on Ukraine.
Right. And Russia prevailing in Ukraine does not mean an end to conflict, I don't think. And I think there's some real concern about where Putin might set his sights next. So to think that Russia winning somehow equals peace, what are your concerns about European security if Russia can claim some victory here?
Well, you are entirely correct, because with the kind of regime that Russia runs, where there is no real domestic legitimacy, the economy is not performing well, Russian population is normally giving support to Putin, but in reality, they are very concerned about this kind of conflict. So Vladimir Putin has to look for external wins. And we should remember that when he started this war, he wasn't just demanding that basically Ukraine give up and that he would take over the country under the myth that he was trying to denazify and to demilitarize Ukraine, and Ukraine was not a real country. But he also said that he wanted basically to roll back NATO, that the enlargement of NATO post-1997, that had to be reversed in steps. So if somehow Vladimir Putin were to succeed in Ukraine, if Ukraine would collapse, then he has far larger ambitions, and those ambitions then would confront the West in a way in which we would have very little choice. But once NATO countries are involved, then we have Article 5. And now we know that Finland is part of NATO, and the Russians have moved a very large number of artillery pieces up against the border of Finland. They are threatening Finland. Sweden is on the verge of getting into NATO, provided that Erdogan finally stops his blackmail of NATO. And so they're on the line as well. And I think a Russian victory would not be the end of the conflict. It would likely be the beginning of larger conflicts.
Conversely, though, if Ukraine gets the support it needs, you know, how realistic is Ukrainian victory? What does that look like?
It's a good question, because this is where there's a lot of debate. Would it mean taking back all of the territory? Mm-hmm. Would it mean that Russia would come to a peace table humiliated and basically accepting whatever terms are imposed? Or would it be that at some point Ukraine would get back most of its territory, get to join NATO, and then Vladimir Putin would try to somehow massage the message and try to claim some victory by holding on to parts of Crimea? And would that be still a win for Ukraine? I think even in such a situation, the Putin regime ultimately would collapse, mm-hmm. because the people in Russia would realize that they have lost an enormous number of lives and a huge amount of treasure for what? For nothing. And even if Ukraine is just able to sustain itself at the current level and continue to inflict the very heavy losses on Russia, eventually the Russian will to continue and the ability to do so may dissipate. Let's not forget that dictatorships tend to look very strong and stable until all of a sudden they are no longer strong and stable. So there may be far more vulnerability in the case of Russia. More than 600 days after they started this conflict, they have not managed to conquer Ukraine. In fact, Ukraine has taken back about half of the territory that Russia had taken over after the attack, the second invasion of Ukraine in February of last year. And they continue to inflict a huge amount of damage on Russia, but they need to be resupplied. They need to have the economic aid. The West has to step up. And if we don't do that, then what so far has been a disaster for Russia, and of course a horrible tragedy for Ukraine, that may be all lost, because Vladimir Putin cannot afford to give up.
We'll see what the new year brings us. We'll leave it there for now. Professor Braun, always do appreciate the insight. Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
All the best, sir. That is Orel Braun, professor at the University of Toronto, also an associate with the Davis Center at Harvard University. Some thoughts on what transpired today in Ukraine and what 2024 has in store as we approach the second anniversary of this invasion. It is indeed our final show of 2023. We got a lot to get to here this afternoon. You can reach us 403-974-8255. That's 974-TALK. My name is Rob Breckenridge. We are back with more right after this.
We're working to develop a plan that will pull together the measures we've announced and the next measures we will announce into a single place for Canadians to see the full renewed approach to addressing the housing crisis.
That was Housing Minister Sean Fraser today speaking with Canadian Press on some kind of ancient speakerphone or something. But anyway, talking about plans to unveil, I guess, an updated housing or a renewed housing plan. And certainly we've seen a spate of announcements recently from the government, and sometimes those announcements get re-announced a few times. But there's definitely been more of a shift in focus recently. And I think a lot of that, traces back to when Sean Fraser was first put in there as housing minister, and the government recognizing that they really needed to get to work on this file. The housing minister also talking about how Ottawa does need to deal with what's been an influx in temporary residents.
The first instance, in my view, should involve working in partnership with provincial governments and with institutions to address this challenge. But I think we should reserve the right to take additional steps should they be necessary.
Okay, so that's going to be something to watch. I mean, that's been a big part of the population growth recently, is the influx in temporary residents. That might include temporary foreign workers or students, others who are coming here, though, and they're not citizens or permanent residents. But look, I mean, you know, the population's growing rapidly. We really haven't, I think, fundamentally addressed the disconnect between housing supply and demand. So what should we be looking for in 2024? Have we seen anything in 2023 that might help us on this path? Well, someone who's been watching this debate, writing a lot about the housing issue over the last year or two, is policy analyst Steve LaFleur, who joins us on the line here this afternoon. Steve, good to have you with us. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what do you make of, you know, Sean Fraser? I mean, it does seem like since he became the housing minister, you know, there's at least been more of an attempt to focus on this issue. Have you noticed a change?
Yeah. So ever since Minister Fraser took over, there has been a change, both in terms of communication, but also crucially, I think, in the way that they've dealt with municipalities. You know, the big tool that they have, the Housing Accelerator Fund.
Yeah.
Basically, it's it seemed like it was going to be a pretty traditional grant program where municipalities come and, you know, give a bare minimum offer, and the federal government would choose from the least bad of the options to fund them and cut a ribbon and so forth. But actually, the new minister is not having that, and in fact has been getting on the bully pulpit and telling municipalities, do better in your applications. So it has resulted in some real meaningful policy changes. Unfortunately, they take quite a long time to really materialize.
Well, that's been the frustrating thing, I think, with this debate, is that for all the announcements and photo ops we've seen in recent months, we haven't really seen any change. Is it unrealistic to think that there are quick fixes available?
Well, you know, in good times, in terms of, like, viability of construction, it's not realistic for, like, quick changes. This is actually a pretty rough time for development because of, you know, tight financial conditions. You know, we just came out of a global pandemic, we've got a shooting war in Europe. You know, these things have placed real burdens on the economy, and central banks around the world have had to restrict lending. So when you have those headwinds coming up against, you know, more liberalization of housing, they kind of come out a wash. So at least for now, it might look like it's not achieving anything. But in the long term, a lot of these reforms will help a lot.
Well, we still have the disconnect between supply and demand. You know, are we going to eventually have to address demand? Or do you think we can fix this problem by just doing it right on the supply side?
You know, the frustrating thing is I spent probably, you know, the better part of, I'd say, 8 years jumping up and down telling people, you know, stop focusing on all these little demand side things, you know, foreign buyers, speculators. This is the froth on the wave. Mm-hmm. What really matters is the number of houses that get built. Unfortunately, nothing changed on that front, and they tried all these little gimmicks. Now, with the combination of, you know, getting distracted by all these little, you know, at the margins things, and not really doing anything up until, you know, very recently to make home building more viable. Now we're in a difficult situation where we've got such a backlog of housing that there's not really a great option. You know, sure, we probably have to slow down certain incoming streams, for instance, temporary foreign workers, maybe some categories of foreign students. But, you know, there's no easy fix. I mean, we also need more labor. We were in a tight labor market. The industry, the construction industry, can't just double housing starts with our existing population unless all of a sudden a lot of people, you know, drop their keyboards and pick up hammers. Yeah. Probably not going to happen.
No, it's not. I mean, can we at least, you know, use the tools in the immigration system to prioritize those skills?
You know, it's something a lot of people talk about. It's something the government and, you know, provincial governments and the federal government have talked about. I hope they can. But, you know, again, it takes time. You know, you need to, if you're relying on immigration to backlog labor force, you know, it's not always a matter of just somebody gets on a plane and the next day they're, you know, swinging hammers. It often takes some time to get through the process and to, you know, settle in the country, get a job, et cetera. But it has to happen. And that's kind of the trick right now is that, you know, even if we bring people to do more construction labor, they need somewhere to live too. So there's a little bit of a catch-22 in the short term.
There does seem to be a recognition, at least, that this is a major issue. And, you know, the conservatives have really tried to, you know, focus on this issue, and their leader has talked about some different approaches that they would employ. I think that's kind of prompted the liberals into taking action in some of the policies you mentioned. So, I mean, does that help? I mean, you know, politics can you know, taint any sort of debate, including this one, but to at least have the major parties acknowledging the problem, putting ideas forward, is it a net positive?
I'll be optimistic on this. I'll give you the optimistic case. So, you know, you go back 18 months or so, it was controversial, the idea that the federal government would really get involved in housing policy. Now, all of a sudden, it's gotten to the point where everybody kind of recognizes that we're not doing enough. So that's a good starting point. You know, it means that we're not going to get as bogged down in all of these little details about, you know, whether somebody's going to have too much shade on their garden and so forth if we build a walk-up apartment. So that certainly is a good starting point. And I do think that it's also encouraging that you've seen some competition among governments. So it started out, you know, arguably with, you know, Nova Scotia and Ontario making some small but meaningful first steps. And then you see the federal government come in and making some medium to large moves. And then you see the provincial government of BC, for instance, actually getting really serious about housing reform. So I'm encouraged by that, and I think we will continue to see this kind of competition for better policy because the problem is not only getting worse in the GTA and the Lower Mainland, but it's spread out to places. I mean, you know, when I lived in Calgary in 2016, it was extremely easy and cheap to find an apartment. Not so much today, so it's getting recognition everywhere, and I'm optimistic because of that.
Yeah, we've certainly seen a lot of these debates happening here in Calgary. And I mean, Calgary applied and received some funding under the Housing Accelerator Fund. We see some zoning changes approved here. We're still seeing a lot of construction. There's been new neighborhoods approved. So we're seeing all of that. So it's kind of a microcosm, I guess, of all of these issues. But I did want to get to something you just wrote about this week. And it's the question of, as we move to build more housing, what kind of housing are we building? And does it match with people's aspirations? Like, is the dream of the suburban life, is that in jeopardy? Is that on its way out? What about the future of the suburb and all of this?
You know, I think people overplay that a little bit. You know, it is true that we have focused a lot of construction recently on high-rise apartments, but, you know, not everybody wants to live in a high-rise apartment. You know, I've spent a lot of my adult life in high-rise apartments. I live in a six-story apartment now. You know, that's great for me. It's not necessarily what everybody wants. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether some people like it or not, we're going to build more suburbs. The question, though, is what they're going to look like. And I think that the days of the kind of car-only suburbs are coming to an end, largely because, frankly, I think a lot of people don't necessarily want that. I think a lot of that is just a product of, like, heavy-handed government. You know, we've had kind of moderately dense, mixed-use housing since the dawn of human civilization. It really took governments and central planners and governments to invent the car-only suburbs. And I think that, frankly, a lot of people, especially younger people, are rejecting that. They want more options. You want to be able to walk to the store to get a carton of milk instead of having to, you know, get in your car and fight traffic for that.
Right. And that's kind of the vision. I mean, it's taken a weird turn, you know, this whole debate around 15-minute communities and what that actually means. But the idea that you at least have in newer neighborhoods, these kinds of amenities that people don't have to travel far to get to, that's kind of what you're talking about.
Yeah, and especially, you know, think about the work from home era. You know, so many people spend so much time at home and, you know, just want to get up and stretch their legs. And, you know, I can walk out. I can get coffee at six different places within 15 minutes with no problem, or I can go and do my groceries in 10 minutes. I think that's what probably most people want. Now, most people probably want to marry that to the backyard. That probably means we need to do things like have more townhouses, have more, you know, small walkable apartments and kind of like multiplexes like you see in Montreal. That's all. Those are all things we can do now that we are legalizing, because these types of housing were illegal in nearly the entire landmass of Canada up until, frankly, this year. So as we legalize more options, I think we're going to see more variety and we're going to reimagine what the suburbs look like.
We'll see what 2024 has in store on this policy front. Steve, appreciate the insight. Thanks so much for making some time for us here this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure.
Likewise, all the best. Steve LaFleur, public policy analyst, columnist based in Toronto. His Substack, it's northofbluer.ca, B-L-O-O-R, northofbluer.ca. His interesting piece on the idea of the car-oriented suburb. What does the future look like for those kinds of neighborhoods? So it's an interesting question in terms of where that's all going. But definitely, I think we're going to need all kinds of new housing. If we've got room for cities to grow and new neighborhoods to be built, let's do that. We can densify and add more of that. Let's do that too. Yes, indeed. Welcome back. Welcome to this hour of the program, our final hour here today, our final hour this week, our final hour 2023, as we welcome in the new year on Monday. So a long weekend for us, I suspect probably for you. And then we get back to normal in 2024 on Tuesday. You can reach us here this afternoon, 403-974-8255. Look, 2023 has been a year of pretty massive population growth. In fact, the most recent quarterly numbers, so the third quarter of this year, Canada's population grew by more than 430,000. That's just in one quarter of one year. And it doesn't appear as though this is going to be slowing down anytime soon. So we'll see what the longer term looks like in terms of immigration policy. But definitely Canada's population is growing, and growing at the fastest rate that it's grown in decades. And that growth is being driven almost entirely by immigration. There really isn't much of a growth rate coming from Canada's birth rate. That's not really contributing as maybe we've seen in the past. So that's where this growth is coming from. And as we talked about, that's obviously putting price pressure on housing. There's a lot of demand, not enough supply. And we're really struggling to figure out with ways of adding to that supply or getting it to where it needs to. But there are a lot of other implications from all of this. So some new research from the Association for Canadian Studies kind of puts some of this in perspective here. Like the population that, or the possibility that our population could double over the next 25 years, which is crazy to think. As soon as 2041, for example, most Canadians will be either immigrants or the children of immigrants. 25 years from now, up to half of Canadians may identify as racialized or visible minority. So some demographic shifts are coming that may have other implications in terms of our national identity and whatnot. So joining us for more on all of this, very pleased to welcome to the program here this afternoon, Jack Jedwa, the president and CEO of the Association for Canadian Studies. And they commissioned the survey and some of this analysis in conjunction with the Metropolis Institute, acs-metropolis.ca. You can read more there. Jack Jedwa, great to have you with us here today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Let's put, first of all, this growth in context. I mean, it's been a long time since Canada's population has grown this fast. How do you describe it?
Right. This is record levels of growth. StatCan has said that that 12-month period to July 2022 to 2023, saw growth that was unprecedented. We've not seen such growth since 1957 at the height of the baby boom. And it's indicating that if we continue along this particular pace, or if you like, the rhythm of the growth, then we could see the Canadian population doubling in 25 years. That's StatCan's projections, and my own sort of projections based on some of the estimates they've offered suggest that their continued updating of their own forecasts isn't keeping pace with how fast our population is growing. So they have to, as they did in 2022, revise the forecast based on the current levels of immigration, which are about 500,000, not counting temporary migrants, international students, etc. So we're looking at vast population growth.
Right. And that's now almost entirely then immigration, isn't it? We don't have really anything resembling a baby boom at the moment.
No, exactly. Our fertility rate has been stable but declined over the past few decades. And now that it's relatively stable, that it doesn't lead to population renewal in any meaningful sense. All of our population growth, nearly all, will depend on the level of immigration. And since we've seen a big spike in immigration levels, particularly coming out of the pandemic, we're seeing really quick turnaround in terms of our population growth. That, as I said, beyond what StatCan has projected, and requiring StatCan revise its projections to give us a better idea of what the population will look like in a decade or two decades or more.
Right. And I mean, it could double over the next few decades here.
If StatCan, as StatCan suggests, if things remain constant, if we're seeing that sort of population growth at the levels we're currently seeing, it could double, which is interesting because we've got an organization out there called Century Initiative, whose objective is by 2100 for us to reach 100 million. And a lot of people might have thought that was far-fetched 5 years ago, but it seems like that objective is much more likely to be attained well before 2100 if we continue to grow at the current pace that we are.
It's interesting because Canada's always been a country where, you know, it's immigrants, children of immigrants, or grandchildren of immigrants. But, you know, if we look at the pace of this population growth, what's driving that population growth, it's not going to be long, is it, before perhaps even a majority of Canadians are immigrants or first-generation Canadians?
Right. I mean, at this rate, within, say, 10, 15 years, the 50% or thereabouts of the population will be first and second generation combined. That is to say, immigrants and children of immigrants. I think the most modest projection would have us reaching that level by 2031. So that's less than 10 years, where we're looking at, say, 25% of our population being foreign-born, another 25% of the population being children of persons that are foreign-born. So that would be half of our population. That's remarkable growth when you think that in 2011, the two groups combined represented under 40% of the population.
So that would be a big demographic change, wouldn't it?
I would describe it as a demographic revolution. We're seeing the country, in terms of its demographic composition, in terms of its size, be transformed in a relatively short space of time, given that the interest on the part of many people around the world to come to this country is very high. And we believe that our economic prosperity depends on immigration, that we'll continue to see those changes, and we'll need to think about what that implies in terms of the resources at our disposal to welcome those numbers of immigrants.
Right.
Our geography outside of our large cities, to the extent that we can see a bit more distribution of the newcomer population across our geography. Those are all challenges that we'll need to meet if indeed we continue along this pace.
Right, and that's a big challenge. I mean, you know, it's, you know, we're a big country in terms of total geographic space, but that population is really concentrated. So, I mean, if Canada's population doubles, does that imply that, well, that means Toronto's population doubles, or does it mean that we see smaller cities become big cities, and who decides that?
Yeah, those are questions I think we'll need to think about. We probably need to think about them sooner rather than later. Our, you know, main focus right now in terms of space seems to be on the housing situation and what can be accommodated in terms of our current housing supply or capacity. But, you know, there are other issues that need to be thought about beyond housing issues if we continue to move forward in the direction that we are relative to population growth. One of which you mentioned is our whole idea of urban space. I mean, we're seeing a lot of movement of people beyond those urban centers into the suburbs or the regional peripheries, if you like. But we need to think about what that means in terms of infrastructure issues in those areas. And have a different type of vision, perhaps, of the country in that regard. I don't know that we're thinking all that through carefully right now. As I said, we're very focused on the issue of housing. That makes a lot of sense. You know, housing is crucial to people. But there's a broader reflection that needs to be undertaken if indeed we continue along the course we are. And we seemingly do appear to be on that course.
You know, the other question in this report, and it speaks to all of these changes, is what it means for Canada, what it means for our national identity. What's the sense of the implications on that side?
Well, we're going to be increasingly diverse in terms of the composition of our population. We'll see a far greater percentage of people that identify as vis minority or racialized. Those are the sort of more common terms used to describe persons who are do not identify as white. And we'll see considerable change in that regard. We've already seen much change that way. Most of our immigration identifies as vis minority. So there'll be a lot of, I think, evolution in terms of the way we address these issues around discrimination, around diversity, equity, inclusion. There's a kind of terminology that we're seeing increasingly used as we think about our society going forward and how we can ensure that people can fully participate in Canadian society and do so in a way that minimizes any discrimination or obstruction. Ideally, we want to eliminate any discrimination towards people of different backgrounds. But those issues will likely become even more critical as we go forward and our population evolves.
Indeed. Well, much more on all of this. As mentioned, the Association of Canadian Studies and the Metropolis Institute. It's acs-metropolis.ca. Jack, thanks so much for making some time for us here this afternoon. Really appreciate this.
Thank you, and have a great 2024.
Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. And you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.